Hello listener and welcome to Not Enough Champagne. This is the first of two episodes looking back on 2016. In this show we're going to concentrate on UK politics. We join you as usual from our bunker in downtown suburban Birmingham. Joining me is my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hello.
As well, for the second time this series, Danielle Blake. Hello, Danielle.
Hello, Corey.
So, to coin the phrase, 2016, eh? Bloody hell. Is this the most tumultuous year of our lifetimes?
The irony is that I don't think we realise just how stable and how non-tumultuous it was until this year, when everything suddenly just fell apart at once. The weird thing about this year is that we've basically, at various stages, we've been playing, can we just get it over with? I hate this year, please bring on 2017. And then something happened in November, which meant we don't want 2017 to happen now.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, as a kind of moderate Labour member, I feel like everything I believed in has been destroyed over the past 18 months.
Yeah.
Corbyn and Brexit and Trump. And suddenly that kind of, you know, NATO, the EU, winning elections, being important, that's kind of all gone now.
Well, on that sour note, some jaunty music.
January, David Cameron was our Prime Minister. Do you remember David Cameron?
I do.
With his nice shiny face. Do we think David Cameron was the worst Prime Minister of the 20th century? No, that's not the right question. Do you think David Cameron is the worst Prime Minister since 1945?
No, I think Eden probably beats him.
Probably, yeah. I don't know so much about Eden, but I still think, given the sheer damage in advancing, you know, very sort of right-wing policy, I still think Thatcher would probably hold that crown.
Well, I think, though, Thatcher, I can't believe I'm going to start this by defending Margaret Thatcher, but at least Thatcher was successful on her terms, and you might not like what she did, but at least she set out to do stuff, and she did it, and she changed Britain.
However, worse, but yeah.
Yeah, but Cameron went in as Tory leader saying, we're going to stop the Tories banging on about Europe, and not only did not do that, but managed to fail spectacularly, basically for internal party squabbles, caused a referendum that didn't really need to be called, and then, rather than sort out the mess, just left and let others do it.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that front. I mean, as you were saying about Thatcher, I mean, she always sort of fought for what she believed in, whereas this thing with the referendum, Cameron's always been like a very staunch sort of Remainer. He's clearly, he'd always been pushed to, you know, get a better deal with the EU because, you know, the backbenchers and malcontents in his party were constantly pushing him to do that. And then, to be honest, I think he sort of overestimated the threat of UKIP to a certain extent. I don't think the UKIP were going to take as many seats from the Tories as he seemed to think. It's certainly not to the point of actually throwing in a referendum, which he must have known would have serious consequences for the country. But the problem is, he didn't seem to think that that they could lose. It seemed to be more of a thought, well, okay, this is just a stop to them, this will shut them up, this will keep them quiet. And then it turned out to not be the case.
Apparently after the referendum, he comes down and says in the morning to, I think it's Craig Oliver, said, oh, well, that didn't go to plan, did it? And it's, on the one hand, maybe it's nice you're British and smiling at a crisis. On the other hand, you've just caused 40 years of British domestic and foreign policy to be obliterated in a night. And your response is, oh, well, yeah, it's almost like you've stepped in a dog turd or something, rather than just caused at least a decade of uncertainty.
And then walk away.
And then walk away.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of that little anecdote, I suspect that's more British stiff upper lip and sarcasm than anything else.
Stop it with your nuance, Steve. He's a traitor and he should be hanged.
I know, it's dreadful. In terms of Cameron's kind of shittiness as a prime minister, I mean, certainly in regards to Brexit, yeah, that's a very strong contender. I'm not convinced overall he's the worst we've seen since 1945, though. There are, like them or loathe them, there are a number of policies which he's managed to get through, which have reshaped large aspects of either the British political debate, just austerity, for instance. We're still utilising that kind of language now, even though all of that stuff has been abandoned. We're still talking about things, especially with regards to Labour, about kind of how is stuff going to be paid for. He's managed to pass a number of some quite very good reforms. Yes, with Liberal Democrat help, but Cameron did believe in equal marriage, and was able to get that through. Okay, maybe the Tories didn't necessarily come with him, but without Cameron, it wouldn't have happened at all. And again, the school reforms and education reforms that Michael Gove put through don't happen without Cameron and the support and him supporting them. Now, again,
that's
like them, but as we've already said with Thatcher, liking the outcome doesn't mean it's not a success.
Yeah, so that's raises sort of an interesting question. I mean, what makes a good or bad prime minister? Is it their effectiveness, the effects of their policies, or a mixture of both?
I refer you to our previous podcast on what makes a good prime minister.
Yeah.
But there's a few different things, aren't there? I think one of them is whether or not you make or not the political weather. So there's so people like Thatcher, people like Attlee definitely made the political weather, and they kind of shaped it to their view. Then you've got a few people who basically, they try and shape the political weather, but in the end get ground down. So for instance, Ted Heath and Tony Blair are two quite good examples of that, where they wanted to be bold, they wanted to set a new agenda, but in the end, outside pressure from the trade unions or from pressure from inside their own party, I mean, they weren't as radical in reforming as they could have been. On the other hand, you've kind of got seasoned copers, people who don't try and set the political weather. Instead, they come in the middle of a shitstorm and they try and deal with it. So, for instance, Callaghan tries to deal with the economic problems in the 70s. Gordon Brown maybe tries to deal with the economic crisis. Yeah. And then Harold Macmillan, after Suez, tries to kind of manage Britain's decline as being a great power. I think Cameron maybe doesn't really fit into that category, though, because apart from gay marriage, I'm not really sure what he really believes in. I mean, all the economic stuff we talk about is George Osborne. The education, yes, he gives full went for Michael Gove to implement the results of some articles that he read a few years ago. But I don't really feel like Cameron's in politics to achieve anything other than just being in power, and then wasn't really very good at doing that.
Well, I think that basically his entire leadership was defined from the word go about, you know, getting the Tories into power. Tories had been basically wiped out in 1997, but so Cameron basically came in, his task was make the Tories electable, get them into power, and he never really deviated from that even after being elected.
No, and the fact that in 2010 he couldn't have beaten Gordon Brown you know, in that election. Again, maybe that accepting TV debates is a big factor in that as well, because that leads to kleptomania. But I mean, how you cannot beat Gordon Brown by an absolute landslide in that election probably shows that, yes, he wanted to try and detoxify the Tory brand, but he didn't go far enough. In many senses, he's a very lucky politician. He's had to deal with Gordon Brown, who was just tired and just needed a sleep. Then had Ed Miliband and Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leaders, which is not exactly stiff opposition.
No, I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, certainly Cameron as a politician, his kind of finest moments on the political stage have always been when his back's against the wall. So yeah, I think he is very, very lucky as politicians go, and I think he couldn't have wished for better opponents for the most part.
I suppose that he was often best when he was doing a statesman thing. He's quite good at rising above the crowd. So for instance, after the Bloody Sunday inquiry, he's quite good at, I suppose that's what going to Eton does to you. You're very good at being able to do that statesman and be very refined. But I mean, at PMQs, he was pretty rubbish. I mean, Hague was much better, Blair was much better.
And yet, compared to the people he was up against, he was an absolute master at it, because he was actually able to remember a joke, was reasonably quick-witted at times. You know, Brown's was never good at it, Corbyn's was awful at it, and Miliband never quite found his footing with it.
No, Corbyn's getting better.
But mainly because May's getting worse, and the current government's just giving him so much material to work with. You basically have to be unconscious not to actually take advantage of it. But the thing about Cameron is, you know, his main job is sort of reforming the Tory party, but that, with his resignation, that basically all went out the window, because the Tories immediately have gone back to the right, where they were basically before Blair came in.
But slightly differently as well, I suppose. Let's pivot from Cameron to May, from sort of the old to the new Prime Minister, because when we were last here in November, we talked about the realignment of the right, and we talked about that economic populism. And certainly that's what Theresa May... I don't know if she's necessarily gone back. I think what's happening is Theresa May is seeing where the wind is blowing and she's gone, well, she wants a right-wing populist nationalist politics. And in a different year where we hadn't had a referendum on the EU and we weren't talking about President Trump, I think what we'd be talking about as probably a defining event of this year was her conference speech in which she says that if you are a citizen of the world, you are a citizen of nowhere, which is very, very closed-minded.
Yeah.
But again, that's just going to be completely ignored. I think we're seeing a new kind of populist Tory party that Corbyn's Labour Party just isn't... We don't know how to fight it. We haven't... She's making a real play for some of Labour's core voters, and all we can do is go, same evil Tories, which isn't working.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't help when you're constantly telling people who might not agree with everything you say to just basically go and join them, because it's not just, you know, Labour members that are going to hear that. That's going to be, you know, average members of the public. And when you've got a message that's that appealing coming from the Tories, combining with Labour basically telling you, okay, you don't agree with everything we say, we don't want you, well, people are naturally going to do exactly that and join the Tories.
Hmm. And even people like... I mean, you can see it in figures like Owen Jones, can't you, who has been talking about...
Oh, Owen Jones.
Because he's been talking for years about how right-wing the Labour Party have been.
Yeah.
And if only we had a more left-wing alternative. And now he has a more left-wing alternative.
And it's awful.
And it's awful.
Yeah.
And now he's saying, maybe we should get some voters. And is then told that he's a Tory.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's just so perfect.
Yep, it's a classic case of reap what you sow.
Can we just end the episode there?
It feels like
with Owen Jones.
Yeah. Well, so because it seems to me that Labour's in a bit of an existential crisis. We're just hemorrhaging votes in Scotland, in the North, in the South,
in Wales,
for very different reasons, and we're not really sure quite how to put it together. Almost, we're trying to think of economic policies that will please Green voters and UKIP voters, and it doesn't work. It also doesn't help that we've got a leadership team which doesn't really care what the MPs think. So we have John McDonnell saying, well, yeah, of course we want Brexit. We want to, we're going to embrace all the opportunities of Brexit, seemingly without talking to any of Labour's Brexit team.
I mean, where do you even start with Labour? Corbyn and McDonnell basically have found themselves in a position which neither of them ever thought they'd see, and despite all that, they don't know quite what to do with it. These are not ambitious guys who are actually plotting to take over control of the party.
Well, I think McDonnell has been. I think McDonnell. I think Corbyn is.
I don't think McDonnell has at all either. I think even though he's gone to run for the leadership multiple times before, he's never actually been within a real chance of winning anything. So why go to all of the hassle of working out a platform and a plan if you know you're never going to win? Let's be honest, no one thought Corbyn was going to win this election, to win that leadership election. It was a complete shock when he did. They don't have a notion about what they're going to do because they've never really thought it through. So they're just muddling along.
I wonder if also what seems to happen with Corbyn is that there's a leadership election and he comes out and he sits on a train and makes a video and is very, very active for the 2 or 3 months of the leadership campaign and then just goes silent again. And certainly on Brexit, hasn't been talking at all. I mean, you've talked about, Danielle, how many open goals that Corbyn's had to kick in. And he's kicked in a few and some he's kind of hoofed over the bar. But it feels like Corbyn didn't get into politics to talk about the EU. Like, Corbyn cares about health, cares about welfare, cares about social housing, which is why we're seeing lots of... there was a call for Labour members to as a day of action on the NHS. And it's like, the NHS is very, very important. We know it is, yes. However, we're in the middle of a constitutional crisis here, lads. Please, can we talk about the constitutional crisis which we're in?
Well, I think that kind of leads into one of the main issues that they've got, though, is that the NHS is one of the few areas where Labour have got agreement between themselves that it is a good thing. It is something we should fight for. The Tories are privatising too much or whatever. Brexit, they're split. You've got Labour moderates on both sides of the free movement debate. Kind of going, some of them kind of going, well, I live in a seat, I represent a seat which voted for Brexit, and I know from talking to them that they don't want freedom of movement. But on the other side of it, you've got other people who are equally as moderates, who are saying, you know what, it's best for the nation that we are a member of the single market, and freedom of movement is a good thing. So on that constitutional crisis, Labour can't have a position because the leadership doesn't give a shit.
As you've alluded to, it's more than just Corbyn. 30 years ago, Labour changed their position on the EU. They went into the 83 election saying they'd pull out unilaterally, and then changed basically to be pro-EU, mainly out of electoral expediency, because it seemed a good thing at the time. Part of the reason I think that Labour's in an existential crisis now is because now aren't really sure what position we should have on the EU to look credible. We're not sure if we should embrace free movement, we're not sure if we should reflect the views of our working class constituents, because we don't really have an intellectual anchor anymore. Mm. We changed our view to try and win an election. That's great. And we won elections, we did stuff, and that was great. But now we're in a new changing world and we've got nothing to anchor us by.
Yeah, and I think that's an issue that goes across an awful lot of different policy areas, and it's not just in the UK with Labour. You can also see it in the Lib Dems to a certain extent, in the Greens. You can also see it across a lot of the different Western countries as well. The Democrats in the US are actually going through a similar issue where the anchor, that ideological and intellectual anchor, doesn't seem to resonate anymore. When the discussion was all about economics and, you know, wealth redistribution, it's really easy to make the case of, oh yeah, we just need to move the money around a bit more. The problem is that's not what the debate is about anymore. It's people have made an active choice to, you know, make themselves poorer in the UK. As much as people keep on going on about, certainly with the US, especially with Trump's election, oh, it's all about social inequality. It's the fact that the rich are still getting richer and these people aren't getting what they feel is their due and all that. And it's like, maybe there's an element of that, but there's also a lot of other different undercurrents and about changing societies and the changing face of society and the fact that change is happening quite radically and quite quickly and people don't like it.
Which is so ironic, seeing as you've actually people seem to think that people are constantly voting for change, but it's not actually that clear cut. What people seem to something that's sort of gone unregarded by Labour and the Democrats as well, is that there is a group of people that generally feels sort of left behind, but they're constantly written off as, well, you're not a minority, you're not this, you're not that, mm-hmm. What have you got to complain about? Meanwhile, there are actually communities where, as good as the recovery in the US has generally been, there are communities which have basically been, well, maybe not permanently, but have been really sort of harmed by the recession to the point they still haven't recovered. And they're looking at Democrats telling them, saying, hang on a minute, you haven't got anything to complain about, and thinking, what? And basically turning to a really bad alternative in basically frustration.
And as you said, it's not just Britain and America, this is social democratic parties all across Europe. And it's that appealing to culture as well, and appealing to identity. And I mean, we've talked quite a bit on this podcast this year about immigration and identity. The need to tell stories about immigration and identity and talk about a shared identity that we all have and that immigrants have as well. And it just isn't happening. Instead, and as you say, talking to someone in a white working class community in Ohio or somewhere about white privilege,
or Wheelie Castle,
or wherever, Birmingham reference, tick, is insane. Absolutely insane. And that's the problem, is that we should be speaking to all of the working class. I think that's the thing the working class has always kind of been segmented into different groups, and was 100 years ago and is now, but it's almost identity politics over the past 10 or 15 years has just tried to emphasise the differences between the working class, mm-hmm. and not try to see the problem of the left behind as a group or precarious work. So the same problems that we see with people like, say, Uber drivers or with delivery drivers, with sports direct workers, you're seeing that same model in middle class jobs as well, like university lecturers is a good example. Birmingham University was in the news because they're essentially employing lots of people on casual contracts. But we're not talking about that. Instead, we're talking about getting rid of a statue of Cecil Rhodes. It's absolutely balmy.
I do think that with the left at the moment, there is a bit of a disconnect between what they want to talk about and what they seem to think is important, which is almost actually liberalism on steroids. It's it's all about that's the specific individual and their identity. There's an awful lot of discussion about, quite rightly, on a number of things about racism, misogyny. But the problem is, rather than just talking about here's how we tackle racism or here's how we tackle anti-trans things, the debates end up being, which pronoun should we use for trans people?
I mean, one thing I have, I think there's a bit of room for introspection on both sides of the debate. Because on one hand, you've got someone like Bernie Sanders coming along who's just ignoring all the minority issues and just saying, nope, if we just solve the economic problem, that will solve everyone else's problems, and it doesn't work like that. But on the other hand, you've also got the minority groups saying, okay, if you don't focus on this issue, you're no good, we don't want anything to do with you, and you're not going to get our support, and therefore their rights still don't get advanced because they're choosing to not see the big picture either. So I think both sides need to sort of look at each other and sort of say, again, try and look at that big picture instead of just trying to focus on just their particular issue.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the kind of the root causes of this is in effect kind of like the academisation of a lot of left-wing thought. It's gone from being about, for lack of a better term, common sense kind of things which affect everybody, like health and safety, workers' rights, things which, you know, everybody can see a benefit from, to kind of an intellectual analysis of each sub-demographic and each sub-demographic, which, as you say, can create this oppression Olympics where a white working class woman is viewed as being more privileged just by the virtue of the fact that they're white than a black working class woman. And 90% of the issues they will face are going to be exactly the same, but because then you've got that ranking almost, you go, well, we need to spend so much more time on this person, and you end up excluding other people from that conversation, which is where the left ends up kind of putting itself in the bubble and not communicating with, you know, the swing voters, in effect, or the people who are actually going to win them elections so they can actually do anything.
I think we should probably leave that there, and we can talk about Brexit in our second half. Before we do, we've got one more episode out next week. It would be great if you could subscribe to us. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, it does help more people discover the show. There'll be some archive episodes going out over the new year, and then in probably mid to late January, we're going to be talking about our third series on the subject of personal responsibility. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com, and there's going to be some articles going up over Christmas as well. Let's go on to Brexit. What gender is Brexit?
Well, the way I look at it is it's obviously male, because we're pulling out of something, so I don't see how it can be anything else. But this is good, of course. This is going to get me into a whole load of trouble with
defining male. Yeah,
yes.
Do you want to have a guess, Steve?
Don't care. you know, my only response is give me 20 minutes to Google what the committee which determines the gender of language of the words that I have, and see if it's Le Brexit or La Brexit.
Actually, in French, it's masculine. It's Le Brexit, because most new words and most nouns ending in T are male. Whereas actually, from what you were saying, Danielle, it's interesting because Italy is one of the few countries where Brexit is female. It's La Brexit. And that's because the Italian word for exit, uscita, that's actually feminine.
Ah.
Which is interesting. Well, I think it's interesting. Hmm. And whereas in German, it's male, it's Der Brexit. And Spain is El Brexit, because most anglicised words in Spanish end up being male. So
Brexit's a bad thing, it's male. I mean, it was a
foregone
conclusion, really, yeah.
So, we have this referendum. There's an absolutely toxic referendum campaign. It looked like it'd be the most toxic campaign of the year before the American election kind of hoved into view. I made everything
over the glorious days of May 2016. when we still had hopes of a Clinton presidency.
And then after that, we had 2 weeks of madness, basically. Michael Gove stabbing Boris Johnson in the back.
I feel like this should be a question on Family Fortunes. What events happened in 2016, 2 weeks after Brexit?
Do you think in the new year we're actually going to see any detail? We're actually going to see a plan?
No. There is some form of plan there, because they were able to give, the government was able to give reassurances to Nissan. My guess is they don't want to share it because they've got a notion about what they want to do, but they don't have the fine details, because you can't have the fine details of it. They can't go out and say, we want to stay in the single market, because they know the minute they say that, half of the Tory party kicks off and it is a great betrayal. So despite the fact that during the Brexit campaign all of the Brexiteers were saying, no, leaving the EU does not mean leaving the single market, you've now got Nigel Farage and Dan Hannan going out of their way to say, no, actually, it was a very clear signal that leaving the EU, that the vote for leaving the EU meant we need to leave the single market. So the government's between a rock and a hard place, where they can't announce anything because it's going to piss off someone, which means it's going to make their dive a hell of a lot harder.
I hate the metaphor as poker as well, this thing you see all the time, as though kind of trade negotiations are like poker. Like, this idea that the British people have spoken, it was 52% of 75%, I think the turnout was.
Yeah.
And this idea, it's this kind of winner-takes-all idea of politics, like, it's not a cup final. It's not like a World Cup where you need to have a winner. There's lots of different things that need to be talked about, and lots of different groups that need to be placated.
I mean, it's particularly rich that, coming from Nigel Farage declaring that no, it's over, done deal, when he, before the referendum result happened, he was explicitly saying that if it was anything less than a certain margin, then it was
up for another one.
Yeah, and the thing is, this is always the problem with the way Cameron set out the referendum and just making it a very simple question of yes or no, when there's a whole load of, there's so much nuance in there, people have got so many different reasons, you've got no way of knowing what they are now.
Yeah, I think you could probably done it better, I'd say, with a couple more questions. Do you wish to leave the EU? Do you wish to remain or leave the EU? Mark it down next. If we were to leave the EU, would you like to remain a part of the single market? If we were to leave the EU, would you be in favour of retaining freedom of movement? Three questions gives the government a notion of, well, what the people actually legitimately want, as opposed to trying to second guess it through polling or just listening to whatever bile Dan Hannan is spewing at this given week.
And do you think if we had a question like that, we might have seen a better debate?
I think we would have. Because it would have forced the debate on a couple of specific issues. Granted, they were actually the issues which came up in the debate anyway, but it would have meant that people would have been paying a lot more attention to them because there would have been a choice between them. So most people would have gone, okay, we don't... They would have gone, well, what is the single market? And then maybe they could look at it, you could get a bit more education on it because it's been put more to the forefront. And again, with freedom of movement, knowing the British electorate, what probably would have happened is we might very well have ended up, say, voting to leave the EU, voting to remain in the single market, but voting to have to get rid of freedom of movement. So it doesn't necessarily make it a nice, simple response or make the government's life easier, but it would at least give a bit of clarity as to rather than just relying on, or what percentage of people do the poll say might have changed their opinion this week.
And I mean, we talked about the multiple failings of David Cameron. I think one we didn't talk about really were the tactics in the referendum, that he stuck to Project Fear even when it was obvious that wasn't working. I mean, the Osborne figure of £4,000 per household didn't resonate, didn't cut through. And there was no positive case for immigration. There was no positive case for the EU made. There was one to be one. There was one that could have been made. It just wasn't made.
I mean, it didn't help that one of its, you had the supposedly Remain Labour team just refusing to share a platform with the Tories on anything, not really making a pretty lukewarm case
When they make their pro-EU speeches, they spend half the time criticising the EU.
Yeah.
It's like, well, talk about mixed messaging.
Yeah.
I mean, and Gordon Brown did make some speeches in favour of the EU, but as you say, that the narrative was Corbyn, that kind of lukewarm response. And I mean, Corbyn comes from that Benite wing of the Labour Party who've been anti-EU for 40 years. And that kind of lukewarm, that mixed messaging, the fact that Corbyn just seemingly could not command the stage in a national debate is one of the reasons why we see a leadership challenge. And we haven't really talked much about that leadership election, you know, Corbyn against good old Bantasaurus Rex Owen Smith himself. And that leadership election does seem to have solidified Corbyn. It has increased his mandate. Should Labour MPs have waited? Well, do you think they just got caught up in that post-referendum apocalyptic madness?
I think so. And I think it shows the fact that they didn't actually have a candidate picked out to actually challenge Corbyn ahead of time and actually look for a candidate who could pose a decent threat to him. And it was different enough from him. Whereas the problem with Owen Smith is he was basically Corbyn but competent.
Yeah, he wasn't competent.
Yeah, he wasn't competent. Yeah, because I think they kind of you could see it was more of a like they've reached their last straw, because most Labour MPs are pro EU and they've resented, I think, you know, Corbyn just that mixed messaging and his refusal to actually make a passionate case for remaining in the EU, and when sort of blamed him partly for the result, I think. And decided, okay, enough's enough, we're just going to go for it now. Let the cards fall where they may, as it were.
One thing, I think, something we haven't talked about, and I might just end with it just because, you know, why not? Are we going to see an early election next year?
God only knows. Maybe. I think there's probably a stronger chance now than there was when Theresa May took over. It all basically boils down to how lucky the government is feeling. If they reckon that there's enough of a chance that they can increase their majority for the final, 3 years of the parliament, so that they can get a bit more, so that they can say Theresa May now has a mandate to do all of these different things, to bring back grammar schools or whatever. Which at the moment, an awful lot of those things could be blocked
by the House of Lords because they were not in a manifesto.
And also might not even get through the Commons because, I think one of the reasons David Cameron stood down as an MP is because he was seemingly against grammar schools and didn't want to be seen as voting against it because heaven help you if you vote for what you believe in Parliament. But there's a lot of Tories who are against grammar schools and the party probably would vote against it. It's going to be quite difficult with the small majority she's got. She's got a majority of 8 and she sacked 12 ministers.
Yeah, exactly. That is I think the key thing there is that she didn't necessarily make herself a lot of friends with the sweeping clear out of Whitehall. You're going to end up with a very, very, very fragile majority for a number of key reforms that Theresa May wants to get through. And I think the only way she's going to be able to do that is by having an election.
Yeah, I'm with Stephen on the maybe, but I tend to edge a bit more towards no because I think a lot's going to depend on how the Brexit thing goes. Because May's currently planning to trigger this by the end of March. She's not going to want to go through this whole negotiation process with the EU and run an election at the same time.
Which is why I think if it does happen, it happens early next year.
Yeah.
But isn't the problem the Fixed Term Parliaments Act? You need a two-thirds majority of Parliament to vote in favour of an early election. There is no way in merry hell that Labour MPs are going to vote for an early election, surely.
Well, I think this is one of the things. There's two elements to that. One is the government turns around and says, look, we're seeking a mandate to do all of this with Brexit, yada, yada, yada. We want this debate, and Labour are denying it. That does not go well for Labour at all.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that, you know, Corbyn's on the record several times as being saying, no, we're totally up for an early election. And if they turn around...
I don't know. What I saw was him being asked about an early election and him running away and hiding behind the glass door.
There's been a couple of other interviews and things, though, where they were planned interviews rather than basically being doorstopped. Not to excuse Corbyn's behaviour, but I think there's an awful lot for Theresa May to gain from having an early election and very little downside or risk to it. Short of something incredibly strange happening and left-wing economic populism taking over the British public, the Tories would be returned with an increased majority. That's the other thing. You may also then see rebirth of the Lib Dems with them picking up some of their older seats that they used to have before, and who knows, arguably maybe even some new ones, because let's be honest, Whitney is now no longer a Tory safe seat after the by-election there. It's only, what, 5,000 majority?
Something like that.
You know, that's the exact sort of seat which the Lib Dems are now absolutely salivating over, because it demonstrates that there is a constituency, in the wider sense of the term, for a moderate internationalist party, which is what they're positioning themselves as. To kind of back that up, there was a poll a few days ago, I think it was by YouGov.
It was YouGov, yeah.
Which basically said, or showed, that if there was a general election and only the Lib Dems went into with it promising a second EU referendum, they would get 22% of the vote versus Labour's 19%.
But again, I think polls like that, though, kind of rely on hypothetical bullshit.
Yes, they do.
And so it depends what the important issue is. Is it going to be Brexit? Is it going to be the economy? Is it going to be button up their shirt best?
This is one of the things where actually the strange state that first past the post delivers in terms of the electoral landscape could benefit the Lib Dems. The Lib Dems aren't running, you know, one election. They're running, let's call it 60 individual elections, where they are going to be focusing their time and their energy on the 60 seats that are like Whitney. So your Richmond Parks. But yeah, so the Lib Dems, I think, have very much got a new potential for life moving forward if they can tap into that pro-EU feeling. And so far, it looks like they are able to do that. Now, maybe that's enough to stop them go for an election, but given the gains that could be made against Labour...
It's hard to tell. And almost because we're in a 5 or 6 party system. I mean, potentially you've got Tories, Labour, Lib Dem, UKIP, Greens. Have I missed anyone out?
Also the SNP.
Also the SNP.
Yeah.
In a system that's really only designed for 2-horse races. What we've seen is increasing voter churn. There's less voter loyalty to parties. Mm-hmm. Who knows how it could go? I think that's maybe one of the reasons Theresa May, partly because the Fixed Term Parliaments Act is really difficult for her to pass, but I think also it's very hard to predict because it depends what happens to the UKIP vote and the Green vote. Who knows? So that's the first half of our end of year review. We'll be looking next week onto 2017. Marine Le Pen, Alternative for Deutschland. What can possibly go wrong in 2017? See you then.